Achron, Achron, Chaviv. We're bringing all the speakers here together so we can, you know, benefit from them all and bring together some of the ideas we've been, you know, talking about all day and some of the questions about Hirsch and us in 2009. So I'll get right to it, and I'll start with the question of the acceptance of Hirsch. We know already, you spoke earlier, Mark, about how each community has remodeled and taken Rabbi Hirsch to fit their conception of what a ideal Jew is supposed to be. And each community has its own problems. My question is, why did they do this to somebody like, you know, Shimshon Raphael Hirsch, but somebody like a Rav Soloveitchik or a Rav Kook, this it did not happen to. In other words, Rav Soloveitchik, the grandson of Rav Chaim, the brilliant genius, the Lamdan par excellence, is written off. Why couldn't people say his Torah is so great we can accept it, whereas Rav Hirsch, the separatism, somehow it got him into the Aguda, the anti-Zionism, and the modern Orthodoxy was okay, but the modern Orthodoxy of the Rav, it banished him from our community. So I don't know who'd like to address that. You'd all like to address that? No one would like to address it, but I'm going to insist you address that.
I could say, I just think it's a question of time. Rabbi Soloveitchik, the difference is that Hirsch was not battling anyone. He wasn't battling, let's say, what we call today the Haredim, the East Europeaners. He was just a Rav in a different community, so they didn't have the same issues with him. Rabbi Soloveitchik engaged in ideological battle with different communities in his lifetime, in his city, in New York, so it was a very different situation. But over in the long run, Rabbi Soloveitchik will be accepted, and the proof of this is that he is quoted in numerous Haredi writings, his Torah is quoted, and there's been a subtle eliding of his connection to Yeshiva University. The book came out, it identifies him as Av based in Boston, and I think most of the mainstream Haredi community will accept him, and many of them have already, and they do rewrite him. And now the secular studies and the Zionism are not an important thing, and that's happened at Yeshiva University itself. So he will be rewritten. And as for Rav Kook was definitely rewritten in many different ways. So I think a lot of it has to do with the fact that Hirsch did not have to battle in his own area. So we're talking years later, looking back at Hirsch, they want to grab him.
But the Rav himself personally was extremely close with Rav Aaron Kotler and Rav Moshe, the Lubavitcher Rebbe. In other words, the Rav was so treated in such a negative way, despite his closeness to all the Gedolim, his help on Chinuch Atzmai, he was not ideologically opposed to any of that in his lifetime. Maybe the philosophy he espoused to people, but he himself was very close into that world.
Just want to actually continue off of what Mark said. I think, despite the fact that this is a conference about Rabbi Hirsch, I think it's astounding the degree to which he has begun to make a name, or his name has become accepted, and his worldview or aspects of it within the yeshivish world. Because I think that despite his ousted, his separationist approach, he really was for so many years adopted by the more modernist groups. And the reason I'm astounded is because Rav Hirsch did not, will be modest, he did not become known in his lifetime and afterwards as a Talmid Chacham. That was not his mark on this world. And Rav Soloveitchik, despite or in addition to his philosophy and his affiliations, Rav Soloveitchik unquestionably has made a name for himself as a bona fide classical Talmid Chacham Talmudist. With Rabbi Hirsch, it's interesting that there's a book called Shemesh Marpeh that I'm sure you're aware of, in which they tried to pick all sorts of little pieces from Rabbi Hirsch and turn it into a responsa book so that Rabbi Hirsch could be looked at as a Talmid Chacham, but most of it was written in German and most of it is not halachic. And there's this sort of this effort to turn him into the type of role model that can be accepted within the Haredi world. In terms of Rabbi Soloveitchik, I agree with Mark. I think that as time goes by, people will pay less attention to his affiliations, probably will pay less attention in certain worlds to his philosophical writings, and because his Chidushei Torah, his novelae on the Talmud are being published in vast amounts now, people who are in the conversation of Torah learning and not involved in the ideological issues will inevitably begin to deepen their appreciation for Rav Soloveitchik's Torah.
Yes, I think for me it seems like that the more time has gone by, the more Hirsch has become acceptable. I think now when we talk about Hirsch, and that's what I think is so wonderful about this conference, it's 200 years after his birth, that we are sitting here, we're talking about him, and he has an importance now, but because his actions had an impact in the long run. But when I think of how he was looked upon in Germany after his death, or even before World War II, he did not have the reputation that he has now. He has been seen as a politician, as one who has split the Jewish community. I don't think he then had this positive reaction. He was seen very ambiguous. And I think if you think of German Orthodoxy until Second World War, then it's other people. I mean, of course, it's the Rabbiner Seminar and it's the Orthodoxy from Berlin, because they had the Lamdanut, they were the learning, but he was mostly seen as a very provocative politician who had done something to the Frankfurt Jewish community where many did not follow him. And I think I would have said that Bamberger, and the way he was against the split, he was seen as the leading figure. But now, and this is very dangerous in a German context, now that Germany or the society or Jewish living in Germany doesn't exist anymore like it was before the war, that people really saw themselves as German citizens and that the religion was just a part. It's not like today in the United States that you have a multicultural society and there are all kinds of descent. You have Jews, you have Italians, everybody has his heritage, and then you a member of the state, but before the war in Germany you were 100% German, and you being Jewish, even being Orthodox, was just part of you being German. This doesn't exist anymore. So now it's not dangerous to look on Hirsch, because his political implications are not actual. They don't have any actuality today.
It's interesting also then to think about, you know, you're asking about the image of Hirsch and how it's taken and not taken, why it's taken differently. Let's think here of certain figures. I spoke earlier about Azriel Hildesheimer. This wasn't a conference on Hildesheimer, and I doubt Torah in Motion would have gotten quite the turnout if we decided to promote another absolutely outstanding scholar, unquestionably a Talmid Chacham of the First Order. So let us also remember that there are certain figures who are absolutely involved, who shaped German Orthodoxy in a very different way. So it's not the Frankfurt model, but it's more of the Berlin model, and it's a model that was clearly more open to academic critical study. And yes, that name has virtually disappeared. I mean, the only ones I know who are interested in Hildesheimer are all fellow academics sitting on this podium, and it's a small group, and a few others, you know, to be fair. So it's interesting to think about those names that don't make it, the names that drop off, that may have something to say to us, and that, you know, but who, for whom there's not even a struggle. I mean, I don't know if there's a tug of war over the image of Azriel Hildesheimer. I don't know.
I mean,
if
it's interesting. The one book I know on Hildesheimer was written by a Reform rabbi.
Correct. Yeah.
Rabbi Ellenstein.
But his grandchildren are now publishing his Chidushim on Shas and trying to get him into the yeshiva world as well.
No, no, right. Grandchildren will do that. I mean, in other words, grandchildren aside, again, but you know, in looking back, it's interesting that, you know, Hirsch has gotten so much of the press, so to speak, and other figures here, whether Bamberger or Hildesheimer, who are clearly serious.
Or David C. Hoffman.
There's another, exactly. Coming out of the Hildesheimer school.
I mean, one would think in today's world with the academic Jewish, you feel that Rav David C. Hoffman, who wrote on biblical criticism, who addressed these issues, and yet I think I don't even know if everybody in the room heard of him. Maybe if you want to comment on that, why he is a neglected figure.
Well, again, I'll use Hildesheimer because I think there's more in his writings that might at least fit somehow in a traditional world. I mean, ultimately, David Zvi Hoffman wrote Tshuvot, and that would fit, but his other work was so, was so academic, but also a period piece. I mean, let me say something that's going to end up, reverberating. You want to move on to the next question?
No, it's fine. It's okay.
But again, many of us sitting here at the table are historians, and I think we work certainly with a very clear consciousness that these are figures who speak, who come out of a certain age, who speak to their age, and very much belong to a certain period. Everything that carries forward beyond their age is, reading them from very different contexts. We live in a very, very different reality than Hirsch lived in. Obviously, we can speak to the commonalities, but again, I think historians are sensitive to the fact that speaking to the commonalities is to generalize. And that when you really look at the particular set of dynamics, whether it's the community structure and the particular dynamic between the Jews and German culture, our North American dynamic and the way in which we relate to modern Western culture is very different. And we have to appreciate those differences. There's a lot of water under the bridge. And at this point, and everything beyond the lifetime, even the first generation perhaps, or two, everything beyond that is simply very much reading retrospectively. It's very much then an issue of image, and which is what's playing, which was your question. And it is about the image of the Rav, and it is about the image of Rav Hirsch and others. And of course, in all those cases, the reimagining or reconfiguring of those images say much more about us than they ever do about those figures. And that's what we're talking about too. We're talking about a struggle for a certain image. But let's be honest about that. It is our issue, and we are trying to reclaim Hirsch.
So is separatism such an important issue in today's world that it would make Hirsch? Is that the reason he's resurrected?
It's interesting. I don't know to what degree most even knowledgeable Jews are aware of the split that took place, the Auschwitz, and that Hirsch, and what he did there. I don't know. In the reality is, you're right. Splitting aside and separating is very much part of our reality. But I'm not sure it's done with any consciousness.
On the leadership level, it may be. I agree the Hamona may not, but I think on the leadership level,
maybe. Okay, so I don't know.
I just think that we forget. My first introduction to Hirsch was when I got a bar mitzvah gift of his chumash, and my parents said, "Oh, that's a really nice set." And it took me about 5 years to start opening it up, but eventually it was very useful. Some of us, have Hirsch sidurim, and they've done other things, but publication and the fact that Hirsch is accessible in English. And it was translated very early, some of it in interesting ways, as Mark has pointed out, into English, into Hebrew, the other thing is, and this is similar to Hildesheimer, as opposed to David Zvi Hoffman in answering your issue, is that they were institution builders. They weren't just ideologues, they were people who were educators. Hirsch's community synagogue and schools became models for schools all over Germany and beyond. Even Sarah Schneer, who was the founder of Beis Yaakov, she was in Vienna during World War I. She saw the Hirschian girls program, and when she came back to Krakow after the war, she said, why can't girls, Hasidic girls who are being alienated from Judaism and going to public school, why can't they have a system like this in Krakow? So institution building and Hildesheimer with his Rabbiner seminar are major factors in whether a person and their legacy moves on beyond their lives as well.
Yeah, let me just say also, we have to look at the literary angle. Hirsch's commentary on the Chumash, not to mention the Chorev, speaks to the modern tenor. If you would translate the Nitziv into English, you're not going to have anyone Mavir Sedra on the Nitziv. It wasn't speak to the masses or the Ketava Kabbalah or something. His community in Germany as a whole, people would read the Torah each week with his commentary like people used to do with the Hertz commentary. It speaks to the modern era, and we don't have that many commentaries like that, certainly not from the 19th century, so it became a very important work on its own.
So then I ask, in the modern Orthodox schools of today, Hirsch is also a neglected figure. I mean, I don't remember learning one thing about Hirsch throughout high school. And I did not get a bar mitzvah gift of his the Chumash. And when I first opened it, it's so difficult to read. The Germanic English makes it extremely difficult. But I don't know if you want to comment. I feel that you know, even in our community, there's sort of, on the other hand, the neglect of Hirsch.
Actually, Jay, it's interesting because I think that that is a response to, I don't think we were in the modern, certainly the modern Orthodox that you were grown up in, you were brought up in, excuse me, didn't have this Gedolim syndrome that has become part of the culture of Orthodoxy today. I think that that is a carry down from the yeshiva world where there is such a focus on Das Torah, such a focus on figures, on whether it's the Chafetz Chaim or whether it's the Chazon Ish or et cetera. Yet there are people who will say that the Rav has become that kind of, you know, Hasidic figure within a misnagdic modern Orthodox world. And that's, I think that's a relatively recent phenomenon. So the fact that you weren't brought up on Hirsch or on this rabbi or that rabbi, I'm not sure
but
if you were brought up on Hirsch's or your teachers and your principals and your parents' perception of Torahim Derech Eretz. And whether they called it Hirsch or not, I think to a great extent they were articulating the position that he essentially staked out, whether it was exactly what he said or not, it doesn't matter. It doesn't really matter. What matters is he was the pioneer of that synthetic view. And I think that that synthetic view very much influenced the education of people who grew up in modern Orthodox day schools and high schools and yeshiva university, etc.
Let me give an example. Probably the first German Orthodox text translated to English is the 19 letters. Bernard Drachman translated early in the 20th century. That became the ideology of these rabbis in building American Orthodoxy, modeling it after not the East European model, but the Germanic model, the Torah in Derech Eretz.
Except I think our schools are definitely following the Eastern European model. We know that in Hirsch's school, Talmud was extremely downplayed. They studied on Tehillim, on Machshava, all these subjects, which at least in a boys' yeshiva is looked down upon. And it's interesting why, and I think we know that in Israel, all the research they've done, there's a tremendous dislike and there's a turnoff in the Talmud. So why don't we go back to more of a model of his educational system?
Before we even address the issue of the, let's say, relative proportion of Talmud study versus Mikra, etc., and here I'm just relying on the work done by Professor Mordechai Breuer, as opposed to Rav Mordechai Breuer, who points out that in the Hirsch school, the most, in terms of proportion of hours, the most time ever devoted to Limudei Kodesh was a third of the daily curriculum, and more often than not, Breuer writes, it was more like a quarter. Now, most of us would not be sending kids, I have to be honest, in this room, kids to schools, or we would, where only a quarter of the hours of the day were being devoted to Limudei Kodesh. I mean, that's astounding. So the issue is not, the issue is, again, to appreciate that he lived in a very, very different reality.
And why is that?
Well, I don't know if, I don't have any original or, my own insight. I don't know if it was simply the politics of the possible, which is to say, what's realistic. I have to gather that that was a large part of it. But what's interesting is that I don't know of Hirsch, I really don't know, I depend on my fellow panelists to correct me, of Hirsch ever going to battle and saying, okay, you begin with a quarter or a third, but we're going to build up. In other words, we want to see a real 50-50 even. I don't know of Hirsch ever having that battle. I think this was a reality, and the fact that you could even spend a third of the day, up to a third of the day in Limudei Kodesh, was actually something that was something of a victory, I suppose, and something that effectively became a reality. I mean, an ongoing reality, meaning not something to change. Just also remember that Hirsch did not found the yeshiva in his own community. That took his son-in-law, who came from Hungary and who came from a very different perspective. So in terms of understanding Hirsch's relationship to Talmud and Talmud versus Mikra, it's fair. And again, it has to be said here, there's, of course, Hirsch wasn't the first one to build a school where you had Limudei Kodesh, Limudei Chol. This was already a feature from the Habsburg Empire in the 1780s. And the truth is that Hirsch's, sort of two-thirds, one-third, or three-quarters, one-quarter split was not uncommon. In other words, that really was the reality in most of German-speaking Central Europe. In this case, Hirsch really bought into it, I think, and accepted, it seems, on the face of it, a reality that was fairly widespread. That was Jewish education.
And I think this is the German context, which is different than we live here today, that Hirsch was also, which I think is forgotten sometimes today, or he was a reformer, you know, in the Orthodoxy. I mean, we call it modern Orthodoxy or we call it neo-Orthodoxy. But he was really, he did a lot of things that maybe today we would be afraid of doing because he would be accused of not being Orthodox anymore. So he wanted to integrate, I think that he wanted to integrate Orthodoxy in becoming a modern German Jewish citizen. And this meant that for him, it was not only technically, it was really important that his pupils knew the German culture. That, as you say, it was very important in his school to know Schiller and Goethe and all these German literature, the German history, because they understood themselves as part of German society. And of course, they did not want to deviate from the Orthodox way, but I think the synthesizing was going on the same level. It's not, and I think that's the difference to Hildesheimer. He did not do secular studies as a must, because he would say you cannot live in a modern world without secular studies. I think if you read his text and if you see the school schedule, you see that he believed that secular studies are a value in themselves, that they promote to become a good person. You also have to have secular mm-hmm. studies. So it was not out of necessity, but it was out of something positive. And that, I think, we today don't see it this way because we come from a different angle. So we see more the danger in having secular studies, which for him was not the case.
Were there any non-observing kids in his school? This, I believe. Does anybody know if we have non-observing kids?
As I said, the members of the
like our community day school system?
It's actually one of the interesting things. With all due respect to the power and controversy of separatism, the observant kids from the Gemeinde Orthodox, meaning the Orthodox community within the broader Jewish, in other words, after Hirsch split off in 1876, 77, the Reform-controlled or the general community established its own Orthodox subgroup. And they had a rabbi, Rabbi Marcus Horowitz, who was a student of Hildesheimer. And even though there was politically tremendous tension between the Gemeinde Orthodox and the Hirschian community, a lot of the observant kids from the Gemeinde Orthodox synagogue went to school in the Hirschian school. So there was actually crossover. In terms of non-observant kids, I actually have some testimony that I found of non-observant kids who did go to the Hirschian school. And unfortunately, it's really very, very sad to see I have some testimony of kids feeling really awful as the non-Orthodox, non-observant child in that school. Even though they attended there, they felt very ostracized. They felt very not well treated, as opposed to in Berlin. I have some testimony that in the Berlin Orthodox separatist group that was Hildesheimer's community, there was a much more positive and even what today would be termed a type of outreach or kiruv, which was being done from the teachers from that school vis-a-vis non-observant kids in the Berlin community.
And let me just add to what Dr. Furziger said. It's not just that they welcome the Gemeinde Orthodox. Professor Breuer told me that there was no Austrian propaganda in the school. That is, that was considered safe territory, so you didn't have rebbes or teachers
in
Frankfurt.
In
Hirsch's own school preaching separatism to the kids, that was considered neutral ground. Even though it was run by the separatist community, they understood that they were serving the entire Orthodox community.
Excuse me, you have to remember that to be a member of this community, you just needed circumcision and a Jewish marriage. You don't have, you know, you didn't have to have even an Orthodox lifestyle. I mean, of course, most people as a member, they didn't ask you how do you live at home.
If you paid your taxes.
If you paid your taxes, you had to have circumcision and a Jewish marriage. So, of course, I mean, children from non-Orthodox families, you know, if they would fulfill this conditions, were part of the school. I mean, I think we see it, as you said, we see it from today, that Orthodox really means much more than it meant in those days in the question of personal life. Nobody was going to check how you behave at home or if you have your, if you eat kosher or if your shop is open or whatever. But these, there were really very minimal conditions to be part of it.
Just But as I think was said, Eddie mentioned Solomon Breuer, Shlomo Breuer, who was the son-in-law of Hirsch, who was his heir as rabbi of the community. And here we have this interesting thing. It shows how much Hirsch was really in a bubble in a certain sense, both in terms of the lack of Talmud, in intensive Talmud study, and in terms of his interaction with broader Jewry, broader society, even as he was a separatist. Breuer was Hungarian, and he came from the tradition of the students of the Chatam Sofer of Chadash Asur Min HaTorah, even though he did go to university. But he was very much much more vehement in his animosity towards non-Orthodox and towards non-separatist Orthodox. If you go to the Frankfurt Cemetery today, the Orthodox section, you can read his epitaph, and it says, Lacham milchamot Hashem neged oyvei Hashem. Now that says that he was the fighter for the wars of God. But Mordechai Breuer, who was mentioned here, Professor Mordechai Breuer, told me two unbelievable stories that show how much over the years the separatism became entrenched. He told me that once he was walking with his father, the great Isaac Breuer, on the street in Frankfurt, and they bumped into another Jew. And his father spoke to him for about 10 minutes, and after they continued walking, he said, he was a little kid, he said to his father, "Well, who's that?" He said, "That's our cousin." He said, "Really? I never met him before. Where does he live? Is he from out of town?" He said, "No, he's from down the block over there." So he said, "Well, how come I haven't met him?" "Oh, he's part of the Gemeinde Orthodoxe." So there really was no contact. And the other story they told me, which was I was really shocked by, was if you go to the old Frankfurt Cemetery today, next to the Jewish street there, so actually a very fascinating museum with excavations, and then they have the old cemetery itself. Rabbi Nathan Adler is buried there. Rabbi Nathan Adler was a Talmid Chacham. He was also a Kabbalist. He was one of the influential teachers on the Chatam Sofer, who was born in Frankfurt. Rabbi Nathan Adler died and was buried before Hirsch came to Frankfurt, and he was considered a great tzaddik. And at his yurt site, every year people would go to say Tehillim at his grave, like they do till today. But Mordechai Breuer told me that there was a problem because that cemetery became the property of the property of the Gemeinde. And the ERGay, Hirsch's community, had established its own section and no longer would go into that cemetery. But what do you do when you get to the yurt site of Rav Nathan Adler? Do you say Tehillim by his grave or not? How can you step foot in the cemetery which is controlled by the general community? And the compromise which was made was that they would stand outside the fence as close as they could to the grave, and they would recite the Tehillim from there. God forbid, do not enter the actual cemetery.
Disunited even in death.
look how great our communities are. Nigatlu hadorot. You know, but were there other options for schools in Germany? Non-Orthodox kids or other Orthodox kids?
Yes, that it was in Frankfurt, because Frankfurt was not only the center of Orthodoxy, it was also the founding center of the Reform Movement. And the whole Reform Movement was started in a school in 1804, the Philanthropien, which was the pride of the Frankfurt Jewish community, which was a very extreme Reform course. And known figures like Joost and others, they taught there, so of course you could go to other schools. And only later, as a reaction to the challenge of the Hirsch succession, this Philanthropien also enabled Orthodox parallel classes. So then you had the choice to go also to an Orthodox school within the Jewish community.
And there was yet another choice, and I say this because this is a choice that Samuel Hirsch's own parents made. There were many traditional, they weren't yet called Orthodox, didn't exist yet, there were many traditional families that sent their children to general public schools for their education and simply tutored them in the Limudei Kodesh, if you will, at home. Samson Raphael Hirsch was one of those kids. He was not sent to a Jewish school. There was a sort of a maskilic Jewish school in Hamburg. They opted not to. They simply sent them to a public school.
And so what age?
I don't think he, I mean, later he clearly went to learn with Rav Ettlinger and he went to learn. Right, so he had private tutors, probably unknown, until a certain stage. And
the
then
Rav,
he
of course, also never went to school.
Exactly. That's
great people.
Option.
I mean, I don't know if his parents up at, they don't fit in any school.
Homeschooling,
that's right. Okay. If I can maybe move on to another area, the argument that Hirsch was meant as Horat Shah, which... let's leaving aside the merits of that argument or the non-merits of that argument, but why do people assume that we don't have the same Horat Shah nowadays? I would think, if anything, America, in Israel, modern-day Israel, is a greater Horat Shah than we had in Germany. So they say, if that was Horat Shah, only applied in Germany. And what about now?
First, you should explain Horat Shah.
I'm sorry. That the there are many people who claim the ideology of Rav Hirsch on his openness into secular education and culture was only an emergency measure. To stem the tide of assimilation in Germany, we had no choice but to study German literature and science, etc. But we today, we don't have to do that. He never would have meant it. He would have never said it here. And that's why we can accept him. Because had he meant it as an ideal for all time, we couldn't accept him. The way we accept him is saying it was very different in Germany. I would think America is much more alike Germany than Poland or Lithuania or Hungary. I think we're all ideologically German or much more culturally German than we are Eastern European, even though we are biologically Eastern European, most of us. So why? How do they deal with that issue?
Why, again, in Germany there was no yeshivas. There wasn't a yeshiva movement. In fact, after Hirsch's death, and Hirsch, by the way, getting back to what Dr. Breuer said, Hirsch actually had plans to open some sort of a yeshiva. But when his son-in-law wanted to create a yeshiva, the community refused to fund it. They said, if Samson Raphael Hirsch, your father-in-law, didn't want a yeshiva, then we'll never have a yeshiva here. It was only years later that they came around. But there were no yeshivas in Germany, so it's not parallel to America, because the argument would be that in America we have yeshiva gedolas. You can go study, you can devote yourself. Again, we're talking about, it's why from Jews, why Orthodox Jews. We're not talking about the non-Orthodox or the semi-Orthodox. The question is, should Orthodox Jews be Torah only or Torim Derech Eretz? In Germany, you didn't have any options, so you had to be Torim Derech Eretz. In America, you have other options. You can go to Lakewood, you can go to Meir, etc. So the...
Our culture, in terms of the idea of sitting in kollel, is a new concept. Everybody went to work. The Orthodox all went to work in America before the war, after the war. Didn't they understand the idea that you needed a form of derech eretz in America?
No, you can work, but you can't. No, but you can work. But Torah derech eretz is not about a job. It's about being part of the civilization. And they throw in also the fact that Western civilization today is decadent. And Hirsch's civil culture was a much higher culture. That American culture today is not Schiller, it's Madonna. So so you have the fact that the culture has become decadent, and also the fact that you can have, you can devote yourself to Torah study and you get a secular degree, the Lander model, Machon LeParnassa. You do it for Parnassa. So the model is completely different. They argue that in Germany there wasn't any possibility to have Torah only, so you had to give them this to bring them in. But today anyone has the opportunity to devote themselves to Torah.
And why is that? Why in Germany? Why didn't anybody build up?
No, because Torah study had basically, since the rise of the Enlightenment and Reform, it had collapsed. There weren't any great yeshivas anymore.
As it did in America.
No, but we have today. So
right.
We have great yeshivas today.
So I'm just saying, in America, we have people who came here who developed the yeshiva movement with their heart and soul, the Rav Aaron Kotler, and apparently in Germany, you never had such an idea.
Yeah, it was because of different circumstances. Shraga Feivel Mendelwitz, by the way, was a big believer in Torah Derech Eretz, Hirschian ideology. You wouldn't know that today, but he was.
I think that, and maybe this is anachronistic, but I think all bets are off after the Holocaust. I think that we really have to always remember that the trauma and the degree of sense of destruction of a culture and of the need to rehabilitate that or to save whatever is left on one hand. On the other hand, the sense, like Dr. Shapiro said now, that America is the Trefa Medina, North America is the Trefa Medina, and that the only way for Torah, true Judaism, to survive is through creating these enclaves like Tells or Neir Yisrael to a certain degree, or certainly Lakewood. I think that is something which is sui generis to post-World War II North American orthodoxy.
and it can't be compared to what was going on in Germany. And also, we should remember that the orthodoxy that did exist in the United States prior to World War II, except for a few exceptions, was essentially a Hirschian orthodoxy. When Rav Aaron Cutler came to America and he said that American Jewry is going to disappear unless we create a place like Lakewood, he didn't just say it about the Reform and Conservative. He said it about those modern Orthodox rabbis who sit on the Synagogue Council of America, who participate in the New York Board of Rabbis, who are willing to communicate with Jews outside the box. So he was, in a sense, rejecting the American version of the aspects of the of Torah and Derech Eretz that were adopted by a Rabbi Lukstein in the school that I attended in Ramaz, or by, to a certain degree, Maimonides in the formulation of Rabbi Soloveitchik in Boston or others, and really was reacting to that and rejecting it forthrightly.
It falls to me, I guess it could have been you, Dr. Furziger, but since there are two of us who live in Israel, and I guess it falls to me to make a certain Zionist statement here. But when you ask, Rabbi Kelman, when you ask about Horat Shah, the sense in which, you know, we're responding to extraordinary times and the need to respond, again, let's, you know, obviously speaking about World War II and the Holocaust is a major historical cultural divide, of course, the shift to North America as a major center, but there's another major center, and that is, of course, the State of Israel. And again, it has to be said here, and this is where I think context is so important, that so much of the discussion we're having here today does not really resonate in Israel today. Which is to say that, for example, you know, there's a large educational system that includes both Limudei Kodesh and Limudei Chol, and it's not something that's a bidiyavad. It's not something that we torment ourselves about. It is. It's a broad educational system. Milechatchila, we send our kids to schools where they learn all kinds of things, and this is true for elementary school, it is true for high school, without, I think, a lot of the ideological hand-wringing, questioning, et cetera, et cetera. So that, again, we have to be honest, in many ways, even the discussion we're having here today is very much framed, as appropriate, to sitting in Toronto in 2009 by a North American set of concerns, a Toronto set of concerns and a North American set of concerns, but it does not translate exactly to our reality in Israel. It doesn't...
That might be because the wall that is separating the brands of orthodoxy is so thick in Israel. They can hear...
You can call...
There's a fluidity between people in the Haredi world, the modern orthodoxy world, so we struggle how to deal with each other. And in a sense, it's sad in Israel how the two worlds are so separate.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, yes and no, but it's not even... I guess you can call it a wall, and it has a certain negative connotation. Or you could just say that the community that we would, and of course in Israel it's the Dati Leumi, it's a totally different line of distinction. And just by calling it Dati Leumi, where the major issue is service in the army, attitude towards the state, therefore the issue of secular studies is secondary to that. It's not separate from that, it's secondary to that. And because there's such a large set of communities that effectively live life on a day-to-day basis like this, there's no one to answer to. See, it's not only just that they're separate, it's true though. What you're saying, of course, is that there's sadly very little interaction, I think, between what in Israel is the Haredi set of communities and the Dati Leumi communities. But that aside, the point is that the Dati Leumi community is alive and well, it's vibrant, it's flourishing, and no one needs to look over their shoulder at what anyone else. It's just simply not an issue. It is simply not an issue. It is very much almost taken for granted, if you will, that to take it for granted may not be, that has its own downside, I would say. But there's certainly something, I think, very, sort of very healthy and organic about the way in which this takes place. And again, in distinction to, I think, some of the things we're saying here and some of the realities in North America, where there is much more of a sense of defensiveness, of the ideological concern, where that simply doesn't really percolate, I think, to the vast majority of the Dati Leumi, the members of the Dati Leumi community.
Maybe you addressed a moment before, Dr. Huberger, about Hirsch being a reformer within Orthodoxy. Now, it's interesting, it's actually, Eddie, who pointed this out to me a number of years ago, when Hirsch came, I believe, to Frankfurt, or maybe the community before, he abolished Moshe Kol Nidre.
It was, yeah.
And because he felt it was sort of a superstition, you know, getting rid of our vows. Hirsch wore clerical robes, had a choir, all the things we would associate, not just in the cultural realm, but in the synagogue. You know, Hirsch made major changes in the synagogue ritual. And just if you anybody want to address that issue.
Yes, I think, if I just may, I think this is the symbol of his trying to bring together or the synthesis between the Jewish life or halacha and the German culture, which was for him very important. It was not just a technical term, how to survive in the, let's say, in the civil world, that he would have, you know, or that his children or the other children would have a job in future. But he really believed that this is part of his identity. So he wanted, and that's why I called it reform, he wanted also what the reform movement wanted, make a more harmonious tefillah during Shabbat. He didn't want, and that's why many, I think, East European Jews didn't feel well in the synagogue, he didn't want to have this unrest during the prayer, during the tefillah. You know, children under 5 were not allowed to come to shul. I mean, you know, that's unheard of, I think, today. And if they were over 5 until bar mitzvah, they had to be accompanied by their parents. It was a very strict, I think we would have felt very strange if we would have come there today, a very strict order. And he had introduced a sermon in German, which was a sign of the reform movement. And he introduced a choir, and people were not supposed to sing with the choir. It has to be quiet, you know. Everybody was to pray and so on. So this is—it was a very German outlook, which he saw then as this as a positive behavior of being a Jew in Germany.
And let me just add that Professor Breuer claims that had it not been for his battles with the reforms, he would have instituted more reforms with a small r. But once he got involved in that battle,
for example,
well, it's hard to know. Getting rid of piyutim, things of that nature.
They're the only ones who saved them now.
I understand.
The German community now are the only.
It's hard to know what type of reforms he was talking about. I never asked him, but he says that in his book.
It's actually very ironic if you travel. I know for one thing, if you go to Frankfurt now, and I don't mean to offend, but the Orthodox synagogue, the West End synagogue, is the big Orthodox. I've never been in a noisier shul in my life. And I was in shock. I was expecting, you know, last week I was at the Spanish Portuguese synagogue in Manhattan, and I thought it was a Sephardic shul and everything, and I walked in, and they said, you're going to get an aliyah, so go outside and put on a hat, you know, so... Things have really switched around. That's very Yekish there, Spanish Portuguese in Manhattan on Central Park West. Whereas mostly you have Israelis, Russian speaking Jews who dominate the Frankfurt community, and some veteran Germans. So that is ironic. I've often thought, I hope this won't offend anybody, that maybe if Hirsch had suggested canceling Tachanun on Mondays and Thursdays rather than Kol Nidre, he might have been more successful.
Okay. We'll open it up in a couple moments to audience questions. So if you want to think of anything, we'll do that in a moment. But I just want to address, I guess, the incident that happened last year in Washington Heights, which I guess is the main center of Hirschian Orthodoxy today in North America, where in honor of his 200th birthday, they had a kiddush, and the gabbai, who was a great-great-grandson of Shin Shom Raphael Hirsch, who was a lawyer in New York, he got up and he spoke that he doesn't think Hirsch would be thrilled with what's happening now in Washington Heights, where we're sending all our kids onto Lakewood, and that Hirsch wanted more of a Torah in Derech Eretz. And as our community, which espouses Hirsch, like living up to his ideals, the rabbi of the shul walked out, I guess he ran out or stormed out, and he came back a few minutes later and he said that the legacy of Shin Shom Raphael Hirsch will not be said by lawyers and grandchildren. And it created quite a ruffus, as you can imagine. It was picked up in the newspapers in New York, on the blog sphere, and I actually invited the gabbai here to speak at the conference, but anyway. We had a very nice conversation, really a very beautiful conversation. He sent me an email, on Thursday, best of luck. he corrected me. It's not, you know, Shimshon, it's with an A. Shamshon, Rafael Hirsch. And anyway, so if anybody or all of you want to comment, then really I guess what I'm saying is, what would Hirsch make of our community today in America? The factionalism, the separatism, you know, par excellence. That's a misnomer, of course, but what would he do in today? It's hard to speculate, but if anyone wants to comment.
But if I may, just before that, before we get to your specific question, you were talking now about his descendants and their certain battle that they have in Washington Heights. But look at his descendants in Israel. Certainly the ones that I know are all actually academics with PhDs teaching at places like Bar Ilan and Hebrew U.
But there are Haredi descendants. That's the way it should be. For Shimshon Rafael Hirsch, I think
I'm just saying. But look, I don't claim to know all the descendants in Israel and the full spectrum of them. I happen to know some of them, and those that I happen to know, obviously it's a self-selected group, all happen to be, you know, fine, upstanding members of the Israeli academic establishments, very much part of the Dati Leumi community, and it speaks for itself. I'm just
right. You know, okay.
Why is it all quiet all of a sudden?
I'm sorry, so why don't you refocus us on
So I just don't know if anybody wants to comment on, in other words, what's going on today, and you know, how do you have a Rav, you know, who sort of can't deal with the issue of Torah and Derech Eretz, even within in the Hirshian community itself?
I mean, just, again, this is a development that already started right after Hirsch's death in 1888. The people who replaced him already weren't exactly like him, and there was a big battle over who would be the rabbi who would lead the school, and then they started a yeshiva there. I think each of these communities have their own history. The Breuer's community, there's somebody here named David Freudenstein, who I grew up with, whose family knows that community very well. Did you go to Breuer's for a time?
No.
But your relatives did, right? So they have a certain history that's a reflection of what Stephen Lowenstein referred to as Frankfurt on the Hudson, which is a wonderful book that I recommend to you. They were also, among other things, positioned geographically across the road from Yeshiva University. And that may have something to do with certain developments in that community. If you take the community in Zurich, which is still known as the Israelitische Religion Gesellschaft, that community in terms of the prayer service, in terms of some of the outer elements, I think, reflects much more what the Frankfurt community looked like in 19th century, early 20th century. If you look at Yeshurun or some of the German origin communities in Israel, that most of them have moved, or Moria in Petah Tikva, towards a more religious Zionist bent, but so did the Kibbutz Adati. And Kibbutz Adati, as I mentioned earlier in the day, many of the people who founded the Kibbutz Adati, the religious kibbutz movement, went to Hirshian schools, and they took Torah plus, but the plus that they took was Avodah, not Derech Eretz. They took it in a different direction. I do want to point out, Dr. Breuer, that it's interesting, that it's actually very embarrassing. Last year, there was a conference that we sponsored in Bar Ilan, in honor of Hirsch's 20th birthday, but we also honored Professor Mordechai Breuer. It was the year of his after his Ptira. But he has this cousin who was one was a historian, one was Bible scholar, also named Mordechai Breuer, and people always mix them up. But the reason I'm mentioning it, we won't go into the details, Dr. Shapiro, is that we invited the family to come of Professor Mordechai Breuer, the historian. And as opposed to Mordechai Breuer, the biblicist, the children of Mordechai Breuer, the historian, who was the Mordechai Breuer before he became a professor, he was the principal of the Chorev school in Jerusalem. All of his sons are Haredi. Whereas Mordechai Breuer, the biblicist, who is best friends with Rav Amital, all of his children, as far as I know, are Dati Leumi. So there's actually a split in that generation as well.
Do you want to comment?
Okay. We'll take any questions from the floor. If you could please come up to the mic. Maybe we'll take 2-3 questions at a time, and we don't have a lot of time left, but I hope there's some food for thought that somebody would like to follow up on. Okay, you can.
If not,
Okay, I don't see any questions yet. While you're thinking, I'll just make a comment on the Breuer's community. I think this is the most important thing to understand. The Breuer's community was an anti-Zionist community in Frankfurt. They were associated with the Gutes Yisrael. But they were in Germany, so it was a Torah im Derech Eretz civilization. They come to America. There are no Torah im Derech Eretz schools. It's not a Torah im Derech Eretz civilization. They have a choice they can make. They can join up with Yeshiva University, more modern Orthodoxy, or they can go with the Aguda. And they are Agudistan politically, but it was always understood that they have their own culture. All the complaining now by the grandson, who got up and said that the fact that all our children are on Lakewood should not be seen by us as a success, it's all their own fault. They chose to send their kids to Lakewood. They had this idea that we could take the Torah of Rav Aaron Cutler and the Torah of the Haredi world, but we will still keep our culture. But any young man studying in yeshiva, if Rav Aaron Cutler is good enough to take his Torah, you're going to take his hashkafa, you're going to take his ideology. So it's no accident that the entire community going there ended up, they still keep the minhagim, the davening and everything, but obviously ideologically they accept the opinions of their Rosh Yeshiva, and that's how it should be. So it was a severe miscalculation made by the leadership of the community, including Rabbi Yosef Breuer, if they thought that they could keep the Germanic Torah im Derech Eretz while sending their students to the great yeshivas, which are very intoxicating in their own way, the love of Torah only. It was a big mistake, and that's what happened to that community. Education is the most important thing. If you don't educate your children in a Torah im Derech Eretz fashion, there's no way they're going to end up that way.
Having grown up in a smaller community and moved to Toronto, I'd like to know, roughly speaking, the Jewish population of Frankfurt and whether or not factionalism is what I see as the luxury of a larger community. If you're a smaller community, all hands on deck, every Jew counts.
You could maybe talk about the size and the...
Yes, if you're talking about the middle of the 19th century, we do have, it's always about around 10% of the community, but the size is about 10,000, 11,000 Jews around 1860, 1870, growing up to 33,000 Jews in 1933. That's about roughly, and the Hirsch community had at its height in the 1920s, about 2,000 members. But you always have to keep in mind that most of the members were still also part of the general Jewish community. They did not follow Hirsch in the Austritt. So you have the Hirsch, and I think that's maybe the greatest success, maybe, that it was a very small community, but it's so well known. If you think, you know, if you sometimes you talk about the Hirsch community in Frankfurt, you think that they were much larger than the general community, but the Einheitsgemeinde, the Israelitische Gemeinde, they were about 30,000, and there was just 2,000, you know, so it's a very small, but very, of course, determined Jewish community.
Anybody else? Yes.
I think it's very interesting to try to look at the differences between the German community in Germany, the German community that evolved in New York, and the Jewish community in other places, because there are always that differences. Now, I'm not German, but I have been to Germany over 10 years ago and then about 2 years ago. And in that almost decade span, there has been a complete rejuvenation, which I don't know if it's unheard of in the history of Germany, but it's certainly significant and requires some response. And I think a lot of that has to do not only with the influx of the Russians and the Israelis, but it also has to do with the political economic dynamic which caused this Hirschian revolution to begin with, in that the community, through its tax system, took the money from the Jews and gave it back to the community, especially after the Second World War, as a way of making up for some of what had happened during the Holocaust. Now, I look at that and I compare it to our situation here, where I happen to send my kids to Haredi schools where they learn 2 hours of secular studies a day. And I pay their full tuition. We don't get any government help. And their education would definitely be different if we did get that government help, but it would also be influenced. Now, I know all the schools in Toronto that teach both Jewish and secular studies claim to be following the is it the Ontario curriculum? I don't know. I think it's a provincial thing. But how could they really be doing that when they have 2 hours or 4 hours, and you contrast that to a full day of secular studies? Not that I think that there's anything wrong with it, mind you. I think that there is something to be said about getting a firm foundation in Jewish studies, and when you decide who you want to be when you grow up, you focus on that area. And of course you need basic reading, math, right, arithmetic, so, whatever.
So you're commenting on the difference between the schools today and in Hirsch's time. Okay.
I just wanted to make one other comment. I was at a wedding in Germany, and the pomp and circumstance is unbelievable. The rabbi with his hat and his robes, he walks into the room, and there's silence. You could hear a pin drop. He raises his hand, everyone stands. He lowers his hand, everybody sits. It's incredible. We don't know about that in North America.
I just want to say one thing. First of all, the community today in Germany is, of course, completely different than the community before National Socialism. I mean, this is clear. Today, you have a Jewish community in Germany, which most, or let's say 85 or 90%, of course, not German descent. I mean, it's Israeli, but it's mostly East European Jews. It's mostly Holocaust survivors who stayed in Germany. And what you said about vibrant Jewish community, you have to take into account that from 89 onwards, when the Soviet Union was dissolved, most of the Jews, I mean, most went to Israel, but Germany was the second country who took in Jews, and that's right, the government took them in because they felt the debt because of the Holocaust. So they said it's our duty to give them the possibility. So they let about 100,000 Jews are now living in Germany, which come directly from Eastern Europe in the last 10 years. And the whole German Jewish community is about 120,000, 130,000 Jews. It means you have a very small, old, after the war community. And so it's a very young, very vibrant community. That's true. So, but it's not a Hirschian community in any case. As I said, the Hirschian community you can find, of course, in New York or elsewhere. And the other thing is that's the German model. The German, and like France, it's a state model. So you can't compare it to the United States. Because there in Germany you expect until today that the state is responsible for your well-being. You pay the taxes, and therefore the state has to give you public schools without money, churches they have to pay for the religious services and many and health service and anything, and okay, you pay your taxes and that's you get back. You don't have, it's not a society where you have to organize yourself. Slowly it's starting because of course the money is not enough. But for example, in Germany for many years there were no private schools. It was, you know, now it's starting because of globalization, and we think everything which is done in America is good, so we also have to do it. But this is a new development.
Okay, thank you very much. I hope that they have inspired us to investigate, to learn more on really one of the most important figures of the last 200 years. And I want to thank you all for attending and have a good day. And we'll see you in 4 weeks on our Yom HaYun on Tanakh, Sunday, March the 7th at Sher Shemaim Congregation. Thank you. March the 7th. Sunday. March the 8th. Sunday, March the 8th.